Hey, welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm going to run through some of the stuff that happened this week. What was that about? What did that mean? I'm Bill Radke, and my panel this week, Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. Welcome.
Welcome.
Hi. Katie Herzog's a staff writer at The Stranger. Good to see you, Katie.
Yeah, good to see you, too.
Chris Vance, former Republican lawmaker, former head of the state Republican Party. Good to see you, too.
Welcome. Good to be back. It's been a while.
Indeed. How was your weekday heat wave?
That was awesome. I love summer. I love summer.
Yeah, awesome. Really wonderful.
Oh, good. The TV stations were on about, like, it's a taste of summer. But there's something about a weekday heat wave that I feel a little melancholy about it, honestly. Because I wasn't grilling and chilling. I have a job.
Weather stories.
The kids are in school.
Our weather here is really, really actually predictable if you've lived here for a while. I mean, so we always get a few days like this in April and May. It's like, okay, good. I mean, I just don't understand why people freak out about the weather, because it's very predictable.
They've been waiting for it very long time.
I enjoy seeing the people who have forgotten that this was an anomaly, and so today went out in flip-flops and shorts and were greeted with typical Seattle weather.
Yes. Welcome. Welcome to the Seattle Freeze. Okay, so this week there was quite a raucous city council hearing.
All right.
Housing is a human right. The city is proposing taxing big businesses to pay for affordable housing and homelessness programs. The tax would be paid by companies. This is the latest iteration of it. It would be paid by companies that make $20 million a year in revenue, gross receipts. They would pay 25 cents for every worker they have every hour they work. It would raise about $75 million a year. The money would pay for 1,800 affordable housing units, plus hygiene centers, tiny homes, city-sanctioned campsites, and campsite cleanups. Joni Balter, Seattle voters say yes to taxes a lot. Is there something particularly controversial about this one?
Well, what's particularly controversial about this one is that, you know, only Seattle and San Francisco and sort of the whole scheme of the country would think of taxing their cash cows. There's a sort of arrogance that comes with being a desirable city to live in, and that's part of what's going on here.
What's arrogant about going where the money is, as they say?
What's arrogant is being, you know, I'm just putting this in one way in the context of Amazon HQ2 search. Those other cities are putting millions and billions on the table to win over Amazon. And what are they doing in Seattle? I mean, this is, you know, national folks looking back at us. Well, they're going to tax the companies that are here and creating jobs and doing all of that. And, you know, look, I am all for more affordable housing and for coming up with some kind of a solution to homelessness, which is elusive at this point. But, you know, we have to ask ourselves, this is $75 million. Is it going to work? You know, we've gone from $39 million city spending on homelessness to $63 million this year. Does it work? Is it working? I will point you to the story the Seattle Times did on Licton Springs neighborhood, where there's an encampment and the crime has gone up. We have to ask ourselves, does more money always equal the answer? And Danny Westneat, also in the Seattle Times, was questioning that quite a bit, because mayors up and down the coast are now asking, is this the right policy?
So I always have to preface anything I say about this, because I live in Auburn. I don't live in Seattle. It makes me uncomfortable to sit here and lecture the people of Seattle how to run their city. With that being
said, you've helped run a county, county council member.
And this issue is gone way beyond the city of Seattle. The whole region is wrapped around the axle on this. This is the issue. This is a really huge regional issue in two ways. First of all, the city is completely struggling with what to do with the homelessness issue. And you see, I mean, people see it every day. And some people's reaction to it is, why are we letting these people on the streets? Others have compassion. And they just have not figured out how to deal with it.
And many people have compassion that looks different among groups.
The county executive and the new mayor and the mayor of Auburn have formed this thing called One Table, where they're trying to get all the region's leaders together to figure out a regional solution to homelessness. People are trying to figure out what to do. And in advance of all of that, some members of the city council have gone off on their own with this proposal that apparently has the majority votes on the city council. It's not coming from the mayor. It's coming from the more extremely liberal wing of the Seattle City Council. And you're wondering, is Jenny Durkan losing control of this issue? Can she get anything done? Does she have any ability to win votes on the city council? The other thing, of course, is it is a tax issue. And Seattle just seems to have an endless appetite for taxes, and if that's what the citizens want, that's fine. But you wonder now, will the business community finally rise up and fight back and do the things that, I mean, the Seattle business community is amazing at what they've been put up with, but this is an assault on free enterprise, and will
Taxing businesses is an assault on free enterprise.
Businesses are already massively taxed. The B&O tax, sales tax, property tax, payroll taxes. This is such a radical idea that, you know, again, it's not coming from the mayor. And people wonder, is there ever going to be a time where there's real pushback? I don't know. We'll find out.
Katie, you got any real pushback?
Yeah. I mean, the reason that we need and require all of these taxes is because there's no income tax and there's no capital gains tax. I mean, not just in the city, in the state, but in the county. I mean, we have some of the richest people on the planet living in this county, and they're not paying income tax and not paying capital gains tax. It seems to me that Joni referred to this as a cash cow tax, and I think that's true, except that, so this is going to impact businesses that make at least $20 million in revenue. There are grocery stores, there are restaurant groups that make $20 million in revenue but have really high overhead, and so their profits are way lower than this. So it seems to me that if we have Amazon here, a company that made, there that had $51 billion in revenue in the first quarter of this year, we don't necessarily need to be taxing these small independent businesses, and maybe we should concentrate on the true cash cows in the city.
Would it be legal or ethical to pass a tax on one company?
Well, you know, Mike McGinn named this the Amazon tax back when he was running. You know, I'm hearing on the city council the vote is either going to be 8-1 in favor of this, 9-0, something like that. So when you talk about Jenny Durkin, how much impact can she have if that's the vote? Now, that isn't really, you know, they haven't taken the votes yet. So maybe there's some wiggle room in there. But, you know, Ed Murray, I'm just going to go back to some of the budgeting things that have happened. Ed Murray tried to bring, and Tim Burgess tried to bring, some discipline to funding for the homeless. And they went through a process like, are you effective? And they tried to eliminate some of the service providers that were not deemed effective. And guess what? The city council came around and provided funding to those. So even efforts to say, can funding, the ongoing funding be go to only those who are actually producing results, have been turned back. We don't want to do that.
So I'm not trying to be an advocate, but more an analyst. What's fascinating to me here is you have all the sort of moderate voices, still Democrats, you know, still Democratic-leaning voices in the city, the Seattle Times, the Chamber of Commerce, the new mayor. Everybody, like, this isn't coming from them. And it's like, are those sort of traditional center-left voices even relevant in Seattle anymore? If the city council is just going to ignore them, the mayor put out a letter on this, what she wanted in this tax package, they seem to be ignoring it. So it's like, has the Seattle City Council become so far to the left that there's no restraining voices from the typical civic actors out there?
Well, isn't that democracy?
It is. As I said at the beginning, if this is what the voters of Seattle want, more power to them. It's their city.
Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, has proposed a new property tax levy for education programs. That would replace, there's a couple of levies that are expiring at the end of this year. And so there's the head tax, there's a property tax levy for education. What about the taxes Seattle voters already pay? Like the biggest property tax levy in city history, 2015, this is the $930 million Move Seattle levy. Well, the city's transportation department says the levy is falling behind on the street and sidewalk improvements that the levy promised, and they'll probably have to downsize or scrap some projects like fixing sidewalks, repaving arterials, creating new bus routes and protected bike lanes. And why? Because their cost estimates were too low, construction costs have gone up, and federal funding is now looking iffy. Meanwhile, there's the money that Seattle voters approved in 2014, an increase in car tab fees and sales taxes, $50 million a year to pay for more bus service. Well, now King County Metro says, this is the county metro, says, well, we can't hire and train drivers that fast. We don't have the space that for all the buses that Seattle wants with that money. So the Seattle Times reports that Seattle Transportation Department can only buy 1/7 of the bus trips it wanted. Katie, what do you conclude from that?
There's too many people here. That's what I would conclude from that. I mean, regarding the buses, I read a Times piece from last summer about how Metro was increasing bus routes in in anticipation of the influx of Amazon interns coming in. And as much as I hate to encourage the sort of privatization of our roadways, things like the Microsoft Connector sort of, they get up my ick factor because I don't like the idea that there are these just private companies that have that, you know, it seems very elitist. That being said, I think if Amazon could easily have something like the Connector that was more robust and would take some of the pressure off of the buses.
Can I just
so you? It doesn't feel good, but that's exactly what those kind of buses are for. And you say, "That would be nice."
I mean, I'm a pragmatist. Even if it sort of doesn't feel good, I think that if the bus system as we have isn't working, then Amazon and these other companies that have brought all of these people should pitch in.
Back to Amazon, Joni.
I'd just like to say that this move Seattle can't deliver what we promised is the biggest duh I've heard of in years. Yeah. When we heard it's a doubling of the bridging of the gap, when we heard, some of the estimates aren't perfect, but, just vote for it. It'll be great. This is SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, after all. They can't count over there, in case nobody's noticed. And I'm not a bit surprised, but there was a quote about when we told the mayor we thought she was going to have a heart attack. I mean, who wouldn't have a heart attack? They had one estimate of some of the bike lanes at something like $860,000 per mile.
No, it was more than that. It was like $13
million. The estimate was
$860,000 per mile. Yeah.
And then it turned out to be $13 million per mile for one section on 7th Avenue and $12 million on a different street. It's like, you are not off. You are miles from what you had said you were going to deliver and at what price.
Katie's first point is the central point and the right one. This region is straining under a massive population increase, and it's having effects all over the place. Housing affordability, schools are becoming crowded, our transit system is overloaded. That's the core problem. It's a good problem to have. It's better to be Seattle than to be one of the Rust Belt cities where population is dropping and nobody can find a job and your home values are plummeting. That's worse. But
so you're a conservative guy. You're not saying the key problem here is unaccountable big government not giving you what it promised. You're saying the main problem is we're overloaded. You don't really blame the government.
That kind of incompetence certainly exists, I'm sure, but that's not what's causing this. What's causing this is everybody and their brother wants to live in Seattle. Something like 50,000 people a week are moving.
Everyone's living with their brother in order to afford a place.
And that's causing problems everywhere you look. Now, I do have to point out, as a former county council member, I know something about local government finance. Seattle is rolling in money, for God's sake.
Absolutely.
Their main source of revenue is the sales tax. They also get a huge boon from new construction on property tax. Seattle's general fund is flush, but that's not enough. On top of that, they have taken all these services from parks and human services that used to be funded by the general fund. Now they have special property tax levies for that. And oh, by the way, things that the state and county pay for is not enough. Seattle has transportation taxes and education taxes. So, again, you wonder, is there ever a point where taxes are so high that even the voters of Kent the other night rejected new taxes for more police? Shocked everybody. Does that ever happen here in Seattle where voters start saying no?
They might for police.
Yeah, I think they probably would in Seattle.
Right, good point. Okay, let's pause on taxes coming, taxes promised. Did we miss anything? Final words on levies and
well, I'll just say it's the same taxes. Department that couldn't count on the streetcar as well as Move Seattle.
Seattle Transportation Department.
Yeah, and on the levies, people need to remember, yes, your rising home value affects your property taxes, but that's not the main driver. It's two things. It's the new McCleary system under the state of Washington, and every time people vote for these special levies—
This is the new requirement for the state to spend more money to pay for education.
And the state chose to pay for that by increasing the property tax statewide. And
so everyone's getting higher property tax bills right now.
Yes, and every time you vote for a special levy, your property taxes go up.
And your rent goes up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want that might be a whole other subject. This question of what taxes get passed on and what don't, is an employee tax on businesses that make a certain minimum amount of revenues, is that a progressive tax? Like, we don't have an income tax. This isn't a tax on profits, so it's not a business income tax, but is it progressive?
Are you suggesting that these companies would then sort of pay employees less to cover the cost?
Or fire? Or raise the prices of your products?
Right. It's about what I don't always understand what gets passed on and what doesn't.
Well, property taxes certainly do, because I hear that from my landlord. I'm not sure about the head taxes, though.
When the city said, we're going to reduce our parking requirements, you don't have to provide as much parking, one of the rationales I heard was then homes can cost less because it costs less to build buildings because you don't have to provide parking. And then I got one email from a design board person saying, builders will charge. Everybody charges what the market will bear. So don't assume that if something is cheaper, that it becomes cheaper, or that if the input is cheaper, then the output's cheaper. Don't assume that taxes make things more expensive. Well, the market, it's about what the market will
be. It goes right to the point of the region growing so quickly. It's growing so rapidly that even though that might be a savings in the production of that housing unit, it's not going to translate to a lower price because of the pressure on trying to find a house or an apartment.
Okay, let's pause there. That's money talk from now. We'll talk weed. We'll talk police. We'll talk traffic. We'll talk miniature horses. There's some more talking to happen because we've only just begun on the Week in Review. Coming back in a moment. Welcome back to The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter, Katie Herzog, Chris Vance, bringing you the news of the week. And after our program last week, our governor, Jay Inslee, went on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and he did us proud.
First thing, before we get to the questions, you want to respond to what I just said about marijuana?
Well, as we talked about Starbucks, we talked about our great voter rights bill, we talked about our efforts to beat climate change, but for you, Bill, I can honestly say we got the best weed in the United States. It's a growing industry. Well-regulated.
It is well-regulated.
Well-regulated.
That's right.
By the way,
Humboldt County would give you a run for your money.
But they're putting a little pressure on us. We've heard from the Attorney General in Seattle, actually, and we need to make sure that they back off. And wouldn't it be wonderful if the first time Donald Trump said something that was actually true, if he said he'd leave us alone on our marijuana decriminalization?
Yeah.
And I hope that will occasion.
Well, yes, Jeff Sessions has said good people don't smoke marijuana.
Yeah, good. So, thank you.
A lot of not good people here.
Okay, so before we get to our weed, Chris Vance, you criticize President Trump openly. Do you have any problem with the way our governor does that on HBO and otherwise?
No.
Okay.
Of course not.
Good with that.
And by the way, does anybody doubt Jay Inslee's running for president? I mean, that's why you go do shows like that and say things like that to the Democratic base.
What are his?
He's probably running for president, but really, wink, wink, for climate czar. So you run for president to get climate czar under a Democratic administration.
And then you run. You never know. You might win. But he's out there doing. He's out there doing all sorts of national events. He's head of the Democratic Governors Association. Jay Inslee sure looks like he's running for president.
Katie Herzog, is Inslee correct that Washington has the best weed?
No, he is not correct about this. I've smoked weed all over this country. Uh-huh. Washington weed is good, I will say that, but Washington weed is not magic. Oregon weed is good. Colorado weed is great. California weed is great. North Carolina weed, where I'm from, also very good.
Where's the magic weed?
There is no magic weed, unfortunately. And when you smoke it for long enough, it really stops being magic. Mm. But the thing about Washington weed is that we also have draconian weed laws for a legal weed state. We can't smoke weed outside. You cannot legally smoke anywhere but the home that you own. So if you smoke in your rental, you are breaking the law in Washington state. We don't have consumption lounges. Colorado and
they have those in Colorado.
They're getting them. Colorado, Oregon, and California are all getting consumption lounges. They can also grow their own.
Consumption lounge meaning a business, like a bar or a restaurant, you can...
Yeah, like if you picture like the...
Cafe, a weed pot cafe.
Yeah, like an Amsterdam cafe where you get coffee and maybe a beer and smoke a joint. And I've been to Amsterdam, and I will say that I don't remember it very much, but it was a really good experience. Nothing weird happened. Well, some weird things did happen. But it wasn't a traumatic experience to be smoking weed in a cafe and drinking a cup of coffee. It was actually really great. And we all know that weed does less public damage than alcohol does. And yet still, for some reason, in Washington, we have these crazy laws where you can't smoke weed on the street, you can't smoke weed in a cafe, you can't smoke weed anywhere except for the home that you own.
It's called Initiative 901. It passed in 2005, and it said you can't smoke inside. The voters approved this thing by 63%. You know, so sometimes our laws and our desires sort of conflict with things we said earlier. Also, Amsterdam has been closing some of their indoor coffee shops, which are weed parlors. And because there was a movement in Amsterdam that had to do with too many of these near public schools. And so they closed the oldest and most famous Yellow Mellow, it's called. And they were closing some other ones. You know, sometimes our one interest just collides with another.
Yeah, I'm 55 years old, and I got to tell you, it still feels like being through the looking glass listening to people have these kind of conversations. I mean, when I was chairman of the state Republican Party, if the Democrats just had a hint in their platform about legalizing marijuana, we jumped all over them, called them loony left.
You beat them over the head with that.
And
you called them loony left no matter what they did.
Well, they were, but the democracy works, and people's attitudes on this have changed massively. The middle class... people my generation, everybody's fine with legal marijuana, and eventually that our laws are going to catch up to that, especially I think because Republicans are going to lose a bunch of seats in this next election and a lot of influence in Olympia, and I would be shocked if the new bigger Democratic majorities don't pass laws moving us in the direction of Colorado and other states.
Yeah, and this would be a really good tourist opportunity if Seattle did allow these consumption lounges. I mean, Amsterdam has closed some of their shops, and they also, several years ago, they had so many weed tourists that it was becoming a problem. So they made it so that only locals and only people who live there could actually visit these places. So there are problems with this, but it also could bring in a huge influx of tourism to the city.
Can we also talk about Jay Inslee's performance on Bill Maher? I was watching it, and, you know, he was off to a really great start there with, you know, some answer. But then he got into, like, you know, Starbucks, and we have great voter rights, and climate change. And the other panelists at a certain point started saying, no matter what the question was, I know, they do it better in Washington. And Bill Maher, he even joked that, okay, maybe I should move there, because he did a performance here in mid-April. And it was like the rainiest day of the year, but it rained like 2 inches that day, I was thinking. But, you know, it was just this, oh, okay, so Washington's just so much. Now, you expect a governor to go on national TV and talk about how great his state is. But Jay Inslee is also the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. So as good as he's getting on the stump and on these shows and kind of things, it seemed a little parochial.
Well, I served in the legislature with Jay. I've known him a long time. He is, first of all, boundlessly ambitious. He wants to move ahead in politics, and he is unbelievably relentless. He's had setbacks in his career. He's lost campaigns, and the guy comes back. I think emphasizing the Washington State thing on national media is very good for him. I mean, Seattle's
why?
Cool. Seattle's cool. We're one of the best cities in the world. It's one of the most interesting, vibrant places in North America, and a Democratic nominee from the West Coast and from Seattle would be pretty interesting, I think.
Why? I would think a Democratic nominee from the West Coast would be not capturing those Heartland Rust Belt votes.
Well, let me change that a little bit. I think it would make him very competitive to win the nomination, because I think, just like I remember long...
You're on the bandwagon here, sir.
No, I'm not being an advocate. I'm just saying. I remember Michael Dukakis, when he ran for president, constantly talking about all the great things that the Massachusetts miracle, how he turned Massachusetts... I think Jay Inslee could. I mean, people here like to beat him up, but our economy's thriving. They've passed a bunch of interesting legislation. I think Jay Inslee could talk about the Washington miracle running for president.
The Washington miracle. Okay. Look forward to that.
There's the name of your hockey team.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about hockey teams and the traffic getting to that hockey team and other stuff coming up on the Week in Review. Coming right back. We'll be right back. We're live tweeting the Week in Review at KUOW. We've got former Republican lawmaker Chris Vance, Katie Herzog from The Stranger, Joni Balter from Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. And we are asking how difficult it should be to prosecute police officers for misusing deadly force. We've got an update this week. First, a quick history. It is very hard to prosecute an officer who kills someone in Washington State. You would have to prove that officer had malice in his or her heart, and that's the highest standard in the country. Last year, activists got enough signatures to put on the ballot a state initiative to make it easier to convict an officer. Police unions and industry groups objected to some parts of this initiative, so legislators tweaked it, made a few changes. Last week, a judge said, you can't do that. If there's an initiative, the legislature has to adopt it into law as is or put it on the ballot as is. And this week, one of those police groups withdrew its support. Where do you think we are on this deadly, the idea of making it easier to prosecute a police officer in Washington?
It seems likely that 940 as written will go on the ballot.
That's the initiative.
Polls show it will pass. And then all the groups that were involved in the negotiations last session have said they'll get back together in January and amend the law in January. You can do that. It takes a two-thirds vote to amend an initiative in the first, 2 years after it's passed. That seems to be the most likely path, but it makes law enforcement very nervous because there are parts to 940 which they just feel like they can't live with.
What's one of those parts?
I'm glad you said one, because there's one that sticks out, and that is a provision that if you are in a dangerous situation, let's say you're a police officer and you're getting shot at by multiple people and you shoot one of those people, you're supposed to stop at that point everything you're doing and get medical help for that person. And that just police officers and other law enforcement just think that's incredibly unrealistic and dangerous, and that got fixed in the legislature. I think eventually this will all probably turn out okay, but it's making law enforcement very nervous.
I agree with that. I think eventually it is going to turn out okay. What's going on now is largely procedural. The legislature sort of came up with a different way of dealing with an initiative.
Blatantly unconstitutional.
Says Mr. Vance. Yeah. But
says the judge.
And Tim Iman.
So if you have an initiative to the legislature, there's a couple of things lawmakers can do. They can pass it, they can ignore it, or they can approve an alternative. And what they did here is sort of came up with like option four that they didn't really have. And they said, well, we'll work on it. We'll bring all these constituent groups together and we'll offer something that everyone can agree to. So now really the argument is not about whether the policy should change. I think most of these groups now think that, you know, Washington's been an outlier when it comes to prosecuting police officers. And so they want to fix this. It seems like it will pass, just like Chris is saying. The question is, will they be able to muster two-thirds support in both the House and the Senate to actually change this? And that is, you know, it might take longer than they think. In other words, they may not be able to come back in January and just do what they'd already done.
Katie, is this about having to stop and request medical help for somebody who's been shot? Is that...
Well, the reason we're talking about it, I don't think is about that. The reason we're talking about this at all is because Tim Iman, an initiative activist and anti-tax activist, took this to court because the legislature, when they were debating this, changed some of the language of the initiative as it was sent to them. Because this was a compromise, I wish that he hadn't done this because everybody could have lived with this. However, I also think it does maybe, and I can't believe I'm saying I agree with Tim Iman, but this maybe sets a dangerous precedent to have the legislature be able to unilaterally change language that has been sent to them. That said, I still think he was trolling the libs, and that's probably a huge motivation for him to do that.
Trolling the libs as in messing with the liberals. By challenging something, a compromise that had been come.
Right. Yeah, he says this isn't important because he's an initiative activist, and from his perspective, I think that's true. But he told Sidney Brownson at The Stranger that he still will not be voting for 990, or he wouldn't be supporting 940. Excuse me.
It's too bad that Mr. Iman's name's tied up in this, because then people in our ad hominem world of politics now and tribalism, you know, but it's not about Tim Iman. A lot of people, including the judge, said the legislature can't do that. And the legislature, they should have known better. I mean, that's just clearly not constitutional.
Well, why did they bother if you're saying you think it can get fixed in other ways?
I think they were maybe trying to do, you know, thinking that this is, so this has been in the works for quite some time, you know, an idea to fix this situation that Washington's the outlier. So I think so much work had gone into it, they just simply wanted to be productive on it. There is an appeal still available, so maybe something will be different. But the more likely scenario is that 940 as written goes on the ballot, and then the legislature can come back with the work they've done and try to impose that if they can reach the votes.
A moment ago, we were talking about 55-year-old former Republican Chris Vance was spinning his head about how you didn't used to be, if you had a whiff of being pro-weed, mm-hmm. we were going to jump on all and think, and things change,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Stigmas change. So in a moment...
Do you remember how politicians panicked if anybody, you know, asked if they'd ever smoked pot? I mean, it's hilarious.
Didn't inhale.
Didn't inhale.
Right. It was wacky, tobacky, and, you know, et cetera. So I want to talk about the role. Is there any role for... we're going to talk about stigma. We're going to talk about stigma about drug use and whether something is a public shaming. That is in just a moment on The Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. So the Pierce County Sheriff's Office, did it go too far in shaming drug users? The Sheriff's Office posted a photo on Facebook and Twitter. You see a man from the neck down. He's sitting on the ground wearing nothing but underwear, unless you count the rosary around his neck, and his dog is by his feet. And under the photo, it says, quote, "If you mix heroin and methamphetamine, you might just end up wandering onto a farm with your dog, hitting yourself with sticker bushes, being tased by deputies, getting arrested in nothing but your underwear." And the Facebook post goes on to describe how the man was yelling at cars and flogging himself with brambles and asking someone to shoot him. A Pierce County Sheriff spokesperson, when KUOW asked, said, quote, "Are we shaming him? Absolutely not. We have people killed down here because of people acting out on meth and heroin." But the tweet is now deleted, and the Facebook post is amended because a lot of people said, "This is you're trying to humiliate and ridicule people." So I wonder where do you stand?
They were trying to humiliate and ridicule people. It's outrageous. If the King County Sheriff's Office had done this while I was on the county council, we'd have had a hearing about it at the full council and made the sheriff explain. It's outrageous. The police are supposed to work for all of us. The police are supposed to be impartial, neutral, not judgmental, just enforce the law. This is the kind of thing that degrades the relationship between the police and the communities they serve.
I want to give an important distinction here. Do you guys remember maybe 2 years ago or something, Seattle PD had a Twitter account, and they decided they were going to make it, at certain times, humorous. There was an officer named Jonah Spangenthal who was writing these, and he was very funny. I used to feature that Twitter account in a class I teach, and there's a difference. The humor that was used on those tweets was self-deprecating to the police department, but never to a constituent, shall we say. They didn't make fun of people who had been arrested. They made fun of the police department. Big difference. And in this case, I understand the desire to bring some humor to those nonstop tweets and Facebook postings. But the problem was they were going after somebody who was in a really rough spot in their life, maybe the worst day of their lives, for all we know, and then trying to make light of it and make it funny.
Yeah, this is really counterproductive. Shaming does not help people who use drugs. It just doesn't. And that what they did contributes to this idea that people, that drug users are worthless. You know, this is sort of a Donald Trump language, calling drug users calling drug users losers. It's really inappropriate from police. It's inappropriate from everybody, and it's really counterproductive. It's just not it's not going to help this guy get clean to, you know, make fun of him on the internet.
Okay, let me I will represent then the Pierce County Sheriff point of view, possibly. I haven't spoken to them, but first of all, you said that they're being humorous. Here's again. Let me read what it said. If you mix heroin and methamphetamine, you might just end up wandering onto a farm with your dog, hitting yourself with sticker bushes, being tased by deputies, getting arrested in nothing but your underwear. Okay, nobody, I don't think anybody looks at that photo and reads the description and wants to be that guy. And it's there's nothing in here that you can say that that's mockery, or you use the word worthless, or calling them losers. It's saying you this is the situation. Here you go. Is that what you want your life to be?
Still not effective. I mean, it's like saying this, you know, harkens back to sort of the 80s. This is your brain on drugs messaging, which doesn't work. It's just it's ineffective.
Yeah. So that's a slightly different argument. Like this, your brain on drugs. Was it humor? Was it flippant, or was it just?
I'm going to stretch the argument a little bit here. The Constitution says the government's not allowed to inflict on you cruel and unusual punishment.
Okay.
We don't flog people. We don't shame people. We don't this was ridiculing an actual American citizen who had, yes, committed a crime and done something really dumb.
Which is the ridiculing part in what
putting,
I read?
You don't think that picture is extremely unflattering?
Okay, that goes right to the heart of what I think the Pierce County Sheriff's Office would say, is that I hope you look at that picture and find it extremely unflattering and say, wow, I don't want to be that guy.
But it's in the context of the whole internet, and the whole internet spends so much time being.
I want to make clear, by the way, you don't see the person's face to state the obvious.
So
this person is not being identified.
Okay. Right, but it's using him to say, you know, don't do all of these things. You know, the internet's already condescending enough to folks and trolling and all of that good stuff. I just don't think, you know, whether it was a poor attempt at humor, which is what I think it was, or it was an attempt to send some scary message. I just don't think that the message works. It doesn't make the guy looks bad enough, but it makes the police look worse.
It seemed to me like something a bunch of frat boys would tweet out on a Friday night. I'm really surprised and not happy about it.
A producer of mine said, "Yeah, you might do all these things and wander onto a farm and hit yourself with bushes and get tased and get arrested in your underwear." Or you could also wind up playing guitar for the Rolling Stones.
that. Which, you know, is clearly what's going to happen next for this guy in the photo, obviously.
Obviously. More of KOW's Week in Review coming up. We're going to talk about the renovating the Key Arena, and then you have the problem of getting to the renovated Key Arena, and animals on planes and more. Stay tuned. The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with Chris Vance, Katie Herzog, and Joni Balter. President Trump called into Fox and Friends yesterday and made some news when he said attorney Michael Cohen represented him in the Stormy Daniels case. Until now, the president denied knowing anything about Cohen's $130,000 paid to Daniels.
How much of your legal work was handled by Michael Cohen?
Well, as a percentage of my overall legal work, a tiny, tiny little fraction. But Michael would represent me and represent me on some things. He represents me, like with this crazy Stormy Daniels deal, he represented me. And, you know, from what I see, he did absolutely nothing wrong. There were no campaign funds going
then
into
why
this.
Why is he pleading
the fifth?
Would have
been a problem. Because he's got other things. He's got businesses. And from what I understand, they're looking at his businesses. And I hope he's in great shape. Yeah. But he's got businesses, and his lawyers probably told him to do that. But I'm not involved, and I'm not involved. And I've been told I'm not involved.
Okay. Right.
Frankly, it came out of the newspaper.
Mr. President,
I've been told I'm not involved.
We want to get to Kanye West.
Apparently, it was hard to get President Trump to stop talking for something like a half an hour while mostly the Fox and Friends hosts just looked at the camera and listened to it all. And Chris Vance, you left the Republican Party largely, mostly because of Republicans' embrace of President Trump.
That was the final straw.
The final straw. And you are apocalyptic about in your language about where you see this country going. And so I'm especially curious as you're on Trump watch, where you think we are.
Well, there's two things on what he just said. First of all, in the substance of it, he just reversed himself on whether or not he knew that Michael Cohen had paid off the porn star. So I think he put himself in some legal jeopardy there. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't understand how any sentient adult American can listen to this guy and watch this guy and think he's qualified to be president of the United States. And the fact that an entire political party does should be horrifying to people, because it just shows that our politics has become so tribal that they're willing to accept anything in order to win. And when you have an American political party that is become enthralled with a cult of personality for like Donald Trump, that should scare people about the future of our democracy. It scares me.
So this show amounted to sort of like open mic morning, I guess, instead of open mic night for Donald Trump. And, you know, you put a mic on a guy like that who just does this stream of consciousness. He makes a mistake in his arguments. You know, he reverses himself in what he'd said earlier about his relationship and his knowledge of what Michael Cohen was doing. And, you know, he's just like unplugged there. He's just going and going and saying things because he thinks he's in front of his friends. Friends.
It's right there in the title. I mean,
it's
in
right
fairness,
there.
It does say that these
they're
are your
his friends.
He's very literal.
You know, so he goes in there and it's just stream of consciousness, and it's dangerous because this guy tells a lot of lies, and the truth will out, as they say, and the truth comes out in that kind of situation.
I just wonder how many times a day he thinks about himself. I'd really like to know that. Like, if there, you know, you have those apps where you can judge how much time you spend, like, checking your phone, if we could find out what percentage of the day Donald Trump is just thinking about Donald Trump.
I'm a little worried what that app would say about me in that
case. Well, you know, Trump is, he's horrifying, but he will eventually pass from the scene. But again, this country has been governed since the Civil War by the Republican and Democratic parties. And the idea that one of them has lost its mind, it should be – there was a Quinnipiac poll yesterday that said the overwhelming majority of Americans do not believe a free press is good for democracy, that in fact the media is an enemy of the state. That should scare people. I mean, that is how democracies fall. That's how authoritarian autocratic rulers rise.
Where are they getting these? Are these all Fox News viewers? Where are they getting these messages? Or maybe they're just listening to Donald Trump and parroting what he says.
People should not downplay this. There are millions and millions of Americans, very few of whom live in are listening to me today, who support Donald Trump, who support this. And
his numbers have even gone up in the last week or so. You know, he was in the high 30s and now maybe low 40s. The guy does have what I call moments of sanity. I mean, usually he's unglued and he's saying stuff, but every now and again he'll say something. I can't think of one right now, so don't ask me. But he has these moments of sanity where he's saying something like, oh, wait, he's plugged in.
Well, first of all, in our listening area of KUOW, my understanding is it's something like 2-to-1 Hillary voters to Trump voters. I mean, they exist.
Mm-hmm.
Bigly. But I spoke to a Trump voter over the weekend. I was at my kid's chess tournament, and so the parents have a lot of time to sit around while they're and hope their kids aren't getting pinned and mated. So I found a Trump voter and chat. You know, really don't want your kids pinned and mated before they're ready. So we're chatting, and to sum it up, this guy says, just wait. I would prefer Mitt Romney. I'm a Republican. I prefer Mitt Romney. I voted for Trump. We'll see when impeachment stuff comes out. You know, that might be a time. There could be stuff going on behind the scenes that you don't know. But in Trump's defense, let's wait and see how Kim Jong-un actually turns out and whether he treads this trade deal and then goes back to the trade deal. He's unpredictable. He's a reasonable seeming guy, this guy at the chess tournament, and just says everything seems crazy right now, and we'll see how the dust settles. Okay, and I'll give a chess dad Trump voter the last word for a change. So let's talk about a couple of things as we wrap up the week in review. It looks like an NHL hockey team is coming to Seattle, probably. Not SoTo Seattle, Lower Queen Anne Seattle, a renovated Key Arena. If we get a hockey team and or an NBA basketball team, many, many cars would head there at game time. And this week, a study concluded that the resulting traffic jams would be not that bad. The city released a draft environmental impact statement, and it says vehicle traffic from I-5 toward Key Arena would experience some slowdowns in pregame hours, 5:30 to 6:30. Traffic heading westbound on Denny and Mercer toward Key Arena would slow to about 50% of a free-flowing 10-mile-per-hour speed. Thus, it would take 9 minutes to get from I-5 to Key Arena on Mercer and Denny. 9 to 10 minutes. That's still faster than trying to get onto I-5 on Mercer and Denny, going the other direction, trying to get home. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I was sort of blown away that they could come up with 627 pages to say kind of what you just said. And also, I'm not buying it because that particular part of the city has become maybe the most congested part of Seattle. The east-west corridor there is miserable without a hockey team. And we all knew this when we were weighing where should we put this hockey, maybe could become a basketball team. Where should we put it? Everyone knew that Soto, from a transportation perspective, was going to be much better. This Queen Anne...
The Port of Seattle would disagree with you.
They can disagree all day because the Mercer mess has never been unmessy, and this is going to make it messier.
All right. Any other key arena traffic reaction?
I just don't understand why we need a hockey team.
Because I want one.
That's exactly. You know, I want a water park in Seattle. I mean, why can't we have that? I want to be able to smoke weed in the street. We can't do that either.
Hockey is a water park.
Wait,
just
maybe you
freeze it and have fun on top of it.
Maybe you could smoke weed at the water park.
This study makes total sense. Look, there's all sorts of events happen all the time in that area, in the Opera House, Intimon Theater, the Key Arena, Mercer Arena. For decades, people have been going in and out of that area for big events. It's not surprising the traffic is not going to be all that bad.
Yep, I'm going to a Storm game
it's more
in June,
likely.
And I'm not taking meals ready to eat with me. I think we're going to make it to the Storm game and back.
I think it's more likely that the traffic will be really bad.
One more story this week. Seattle-based Alaska Airlines has a new policy on emotional support animals. You know, people have complained about passengers bringing their pets onto airplanes and claiming their emotional support animals, mostly dogs and cats, but sometimes frogs and apparently goats, because Alaska Airlines announced that starting next week, if you want to bring an animal on board, you have to, first of all, show its health and behavioral records and a signed document from a medical professional, and you have to show it at least 48 hours before your plane leaves. And that animal cannot be an amphibian or a goat or any other animal with hooves. Sounds like the Old Testament. It cannot be an animal with tusks or horns. But there is an exception for trained miniature horses, because miniature horses are recognized as service animals under the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's something different. That's an animal trained and certified to help people with physical disabilities. I'd never seen a miniature horse on a plane, but apparently they live longer than dogs and they have good memories, and you can get very cute sneakers for horses so they can walk around more easily.
Can you get diapers though?
Yeah, that's a problem, though. There's pros and cons, miniature horse versus dog, because for one thing, the horses, you have to find hay and grass for them, and they produce waste more or less constantly. The dog's much better at that on the plane.
I think the pendulum is swinging back towards sanity here. Again, sounding old, when I was younger, you had guide dogs for the blind, that's it. And now people can bring almost any kind of creature anywhere. In our neighborhood, some neighbors have really, really pushed back at the Fred Meyer for allowing all these animals in, like, this is where I buy my food, okay? And you've got these service animals.
Goat.
And they're dirty, and they're okay. And so, and all of a sudden, I'm seeing fewer critters in Fred Meyer. I think the pendulum, as often happens, is swinging back towards sanity.
Well, it's a great collision between reduced space on planes, you know, the ever shrinking seat, and the increase in the use of this. Yes, airplanes are becoming Noah's Ark. We all get that. But, you know, first of all, I didn't know that you could earlier have a goat or, you know.
I didn't know that either.
Because I've never seen one. But that is, you know, look, they're going to have to come up with some rules as more people use this.
Yeah, Seattle, I'm very glad they're doing this. I've written maybe 5 or 6 articles about emotional support animals, which I refer to as pets this year. This has been a huge story this year. But Seattle is the only city I've ever been to where you regularly see dogs in coffee shops and restaurants. I think it's disgusting. And I have a solution for everyone. I recently got a robot dog for a story for the Stranger's Pet issue, and it's really cute. Its name is Trixie. You can take it everywhere. You actually don't look that much weirder than you would if you had a miniature horse on a plane.
But did you call the airline and tell them that you're bringing it?
I just put it in my bag. They didn't even know.
Did you know that airlines may allow as service animals pigs and monkeys? And there's a monkey college in Boston. It's the one and only in the country. It's called Monkey College. And apparently, Capuchin monkeys are very good at helping people by retrieving objects for them, helping with a drink of water, turning pages, scratching itches, pushing buttons on phones and computers.
It's like a child.
It's like a child and bonding.
Cuter.
Exactly. And cuter. So I would love to fly with a miniature horse and a monkey.
Well,
myself.
Just as long as you call them early enough, I think you're set.
No biting, no problem. That's the Week in Review. Thanks for coming, you guys.
You betcha.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
This is Chris Vance, former Republican, lawmaker, King County state lawmaker, Republican Party chair.
Yep.
Now Democratic Socialist?
No.
Okay.
Centrist Independent.
Centrist Independent. We've had Katie Herzog, staff writer at The Stranger, with us today. Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, wrapping up the week for you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to get back at it on Monday with The Record, so stay tuned.